From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a writer explores Ashanti Hamilton's first year as Milwaukee Common Council president and his style of public policy.
It may just be that people weren't used to seeing all of this stuff quite out in front in the way it's been.
Then Umbrella Group takes on the challenge of performing Macbeth in a college virtual reality lab.
There's a big challenge with the scenes of incorporating the video insets of like Hecate and the witches, because for most of those scenes, once we have the scenery backdrop and as those videos are implanted in there, the whole scene has to roll like a karaoke track.
Plus a murder mystery set around a Macbeth performance, bubbler talk, and the monthly beatdown with John Seeger.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's been about a year since Alderman Ashanti Hamilton was elected to the presidency of the Milwaukee Common Council. The election took some by surprise, but others had already noted Hamilton's rising political star.
His rise and his first year in that office is the subject of an analysis in the April issue of Milwaukee Magazine. It's by contributing writer Eric Gunn, who joined us in the studio and explained why he found Hamilton a compelling subject.
Well, to start with, he is the president of the Common Council, so that puts him at a particular point of power within the city government. His election to that position a year ago was a bit of a surprise.
For people who don't remember what happened, he ousted the previous sitting president, Michael Murphy. What was the story there?
Well, what happened was he managed to basically put together a very unusual coalition of, on the one hand, more conservative Southside alders, as well as a big core of African-American North and Northwest Side folks. And people raised their eyebrows at that at the time. And I think there were people who may have wondered how long that was going to last, given the seemingly disparity of interests there. On the other hand, it's a four-year term, so a lot can happen in that time.
Well, and a lot has already kind of happened. The coalition has seemed tenuous at times. Can you talk about what's put the strain on the relationship in this coalition from time to time in the last year?
Well, I think a big part of what happened was in the aftermath of the events in Sherman Park last August, the Public Safety Committee, which Alderman Bob Donovan, just months ago, previous to having lost the mayoral race to Tom Barrett, the Public Safety Committee put out a sort of plan, master plan for public safety matters that really kind of emphasized initially the kind of law and order kind of planks and things like boot camps for at-risk people and more police and so on. That got a lot of blowback, and fairly quickly that was rewritten and community engagement was moved to the top of that list. And Hamilton was perhaps a little bit put on the defensive. This was the guy he'd appointed to that, but he made it clear from the get-go that this was just kind of one piece of a much bigger agenda. Some months later, several of the Southside aldermen that had been, again, part of this unusual coalition that brought him into brought Mr. Hamilton into power, there was put out a open letter to Chief Flynn, calling basically for more police officers on the South Side, and not even the day was over that Ashanti Hamilton put out a very toughly worded press release saying, "Wait a second, you guys need to look at the entire city. You're not just looking at your own interests." And I think when that happened, there were people who kind of wondered, okay, was the honeymoon not just over, but divorce papers ready to be filed, so to speak. But in point of fact, they seem to have patched up whatever argument was taking place there. And when I asked Alderman Donovan a few months after this, in preparing for this story, he said, you know, we get on fine. I like the guy. He has my support, all that kind of thing. And when I asked Shawnee Hamilton, well, you know, people would have said, gee, that's not the kind of thing you go so public with. He said, why, in essence, not quite literally, but in essence, why not? People need to see, from his point of view, how the kind of the messy, the sausage-making side.
Made. Yes, exactly.
The sausage-making side of city government. And yeah, we have our arguments, and we work through them, and we move on. And that was the kind of the tone that he was trying to set. And when all is said and done, somebody else said to me, well, yeah, there is a little more drama going on, but things are ultimately getting done. A budget passed, and a deal worked out to potentially ensure that the new basketball arena will have a broader employment mandate for reaching the less served parts of the population. So it may just be that people weren't used to seeing all of this stuff quite out in front in the way it's been.
You did find at least one or two people out there who have been critical of Hamilton's performance in this role?
Yeah, although how much to really, how much emphasis to put on that is, I think, an open question. Specifically, Craig Peterson, who many saw as the sort of mastermind behind getting him into power, was critical, talked about his disappointment. But one has to really look at maybe what Mr. Peterson's motives might have been in the first place. Number one, Ashanti Hamilton said to me, look, you know, I was reaching out to these folks, you know, long before he entered the picture. Sure, he was at, you know, one exchange with one individual, not Donovan, incidentally, but one of the other Southside aldermen. But he wants to be there. He's a political player. That's what's going to happen. But he hadn't, as he said, I haven't spoken to him since I was inaugurated. And at the time of the interview, that was 10 months before.
You can make the point that, you know, find me a politician that everybody approves of.
Well, there's that. Absolutely. And certainly people in the mayor's office seem to feel like they could work with Hamilton and have been working with Hamilton. And he's clearly energetic and, as the words that Tom Barrett used, they don't really get themselves involved again in those sort of little internal dramas. And that doesn't, from their point of view, seem to have, you know, stopped the works at all.
Well, and you mentioned the mayor. The mayor still has a lot left on his current term. Do you have a sense for what Ashanti Hamilton's political future might be?
I think, you know, no politician at this point in his position is going to come out and say, yeah, I'm anxious to do that. You know, I would be pretty surprised if he doesn't end up running. That said, you know, there's probably going to be quite a lot of folks. Once Mr. Barrett leaves office, there's going to be quite a lot of folks who are going to go for that, as Hamilton himself acknowledged in our interview, but as several other people who I asked about that same question pointed out quite bluntly. So, yeah, I'm quite sure that he would like to see himself in that at some point. And how formidable a candidate he'll be, I think it's really kind of too early to predict. He is not, I think, turned out to be what some people would have hoped he might have been, namely some kind of foil against the mayor's office. But I'm not absolutely convinced, and nor certainly is Ashanti Hamilton convinced, that that would have been served any real useful purpose in terms of getting the city's work done.
Well, certainly an elected official to watch.
I think so.
Eric Gunn, thanks.
Thank you.
Writer Eric Gunn's article on Milwaukee Common Council President Ashanti Hamilton is in the April issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
We'll take a quick break and then visit an unlikely place to watch Shakespeare. Why a virtual reality lab in the basement of a university engineering building is the place to put on Macbeth when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
When you see him, look him in the eye, look him in the eye, and he won't dare to follow.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. One of the signature lines of Shakespeare's tragedy, Macbeth, is this a dagger I see before me? In traditional productions of the play, only the actor playing Macbeth can envision that dagger. But thanks to advanced digital technologies such as 3D glasses, the audience for Umbrella Group's production can say, yes, it is a dagger you see before you.
The production takes place in an unusual place for Shakespeare, Marquette's Marvel Lab, the visualization lab in the School of Engineering. Chris Larkey is a visualization technology specialist at the lab, and I joined him along with Umbrella Group's Beau Johnson, who directs the production, Libby Amato, who plays Lady Macbeth, and Todd Denning, who plays the title role and also adapted the script for this production. Larkey starts us off by describing the space.
Well, it's normally set up as a classroom and a visualization lab for the College of Engineering. So we do a lot of biomedical engineering classes in here where we'll bring in groups of students and look at data of like carotid arteries and fluid simulations and CAD models and things like that.
And so that can all be the 3D stuff that we're experiencing here, or are you doing, is it always 3D or?
It's always 3D. The thing is that it's normally like a complex data visualization that's highly interactive, used like as a professor would use it as a visual aid for a lecture to a class.
Okay.
Plays are a little bit different because they're scripted, they're linear, and so the interaction design is very different.
Bo, how did you get the idea to stage Macbeth in this lab using this technology in addition to the actual actors?
Well, actually, I didn't. Maybe we should throw that question to Todd, because
okay.
It was his idea, really.
Okay, Todd, then let me jump to you.
Well, excellent. I'm also an adjunct faculty member. I teach in the College of Communications in the theater department at Marquette as well. And over the last couple of years in the Viz Lab, in terms of expanding some of the uses and functions of the room, the Viz Lab had, and even with some of the theater students, had done a couple of projects using the visualization lab as a digital backdrop for some performance pieces, and in expanding of that, talking about the idea of adapting Macbeth to live in a world of digital scenery, and looking at that play, because again, with the size of the space, as you mentioned, a full cast is just not going to fit in here, and so finding a way to find a play that might fit in well with you incorporating the digital world of the scenery elements, and a play that could be adapted and compressed to play straight through in about an hour and a half. With four actors. And so went through a couple of renditions of the script with four and five actors, and just with the space settled on a four-actor adaptation. And I approached both Beau and Chris more than a year ago with the possibility of exploring the notion of doing production. So about over a year ago, we began spinning the wheels about talking about something, a project like this occurring in here.
So now, the thing that I just saw, which was the witches mm-hmm. in the cave, it's one of the famous scenes in mm-hmm. Macbeth. Obviously, there were three actors who were filmed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the part that I'm trying to understand how you piece it together. How did you decide what was going to be part of Chris's domain and what was going to be part of the four actors who are living and breathing right now's domain?
Once Todd introduced me to Chris and we were over here and I saw what the space could do, and I had seen a show in here previously, so I had a little bit of an idea of some of the capability, but I really thought that with this video and graphic capability to sort of make things appear and disappear and the ability to float things in midair, Macbeth was such a great choice for that because there is so much supernatural. Now, Todd, in his original adaptation, was thinking that the witches would still be live on stage, but I just decided that everything that was supernatural Banquo's ghost, the witches, anything that was otherworldly, why not put that into the world of the graphics and visual technology of the space? Because that way we could do things like you just saw, where the witches can become sort of translucent, they can appear and disappear. And then the Banquo's ghost scene, Chris did some fantastic things getting Banquo's ghost to just sort of appear little bits at a time, and I don't want to give that away, but it's really cool. And just the way things float, and the dagger scene, is this a dagger I see before me? Now, in a lot of productions, they go with the concept that it's all in Macbeth's imagination, and you never see those things. You just believe that Macbeth is having a hallucination.
You believe that he believes.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. That it's, you know, that he's going through some sort of madness, and that what he's saying he sees in his mind, but the audience never sees it. Where in this space with this capability, I was like, no, we're going to see that. and we do. It's great.
And it was very interesting, because when we first met, I too had seen a production in here in utilizing some of this. But when we first met with Chris, I remember our first conversations was just a list of, can we do this? Can we do that? You know, is it possible to do this? And so I think it was really exciting to just kind of see, you know, how we can really use this digital world. And there are some moments of getting a pause of like, can we do that? And so it's really been a really wonderful process of just seeing what, you know, how we can use the space, things that are there, and so I don't know, I'd just be interested, you know, with Chris about in terms of finding more flexibility and more ways to use the space.
Was there anything that they asked you to do that you went, no, that's science fiction?
There's just a lot of things that are just level of detail is the limitation. I mean, my background is actually in video production, and so doing theatrical projects is really something I get pretty excited about. A lot of people assume I'm an engineer, but I'm really not at all. So the stuff that's video oriented came pretty natural to me. So I mean, I had a lot of fun doing After Effects stuff in here. I kind of wish we had more architecture in the space. The cave is really good at doing spaces that are much larger than the room, larger than life. And so I just wish we had more time to just design more elaborate castles in general.
Do we see the wood marching? Do we see Burnham Wood come? Was that one of the ones you couldn't get in?
We're opening tomorrow, and it's not done yet. So I've tried.
So I won't keep you too long, is what I'm saying. Yes.
Yeah. So we're still trying to get that to work.
Okay. Very cool. Well, Libby, I want to ask you from an actor's perspective, what is it like to work with a digital world in this way?
Well, you know, that was one of the things going in that we really were a little unsure of, you know, what's it going to be? How much will we be able to see? Will we have reference points? And as it turns out, while we don't see things in 3D, we won't be able to see what the audience sees. You know, we do get a really good sense of this beautiful world that's around us. And there are scenes where we have to be careful. The banquet scene, mm-hmm. We have a beautiful table that extends out into the space. So one of the things that we have to be very aware of is that we don't walk through the table. So there are challenges and things like that. But it also provides us with just so many wonderful things to play with. And I know there was the discussion of whether or not the witches would be live on stage. And as an actor, I got to say, in a four-person production of Macbeth, we're pretty happy that those were able to be recorded ahead of time. So it's like, okay, cross that off the list. Then we can focus on the other characters a little more.
Yeah, in some ways it's almost like doing a movie, what you're doing. Is, you know, the video production, yeah. It's like you put scenes together out of order, mm-hmm. and then it all comes together at the end with the live portion of it to kind of create it anew.
And there's a big challenge with the scenes of incorporating the video insets of like Hecate and the witches, because for most of those scenes, with once we have the scenery backdrop and as those videos are implanted in there, the whole scene has to roll like a karaoke track. So in terms of our timing, and for smaller lines, it's not an issue. But for, you know, if you've got a paragraph speech in the middle of that, of just knowing that video is rolling, and so in terms of the execution of that speech, in the timing is has to be very consistent, because if I finish too soon, then there's a gap of waiting for the next line, and if I go too long, then I'm going to get cut off. So a lot of working with that and timing that out, that there is an element of playing that along, that the rhythms have to maintain a high level of consistency to have that fluidity with all of the images that are being projected as well.
And yet you still have to make it seem like the lines are just now coming out of your mouth.
And that's the challenge.
I bet it is. Is it different? I mean, obviously, anytime you're in a play, mm-hmm. you're in the world of the play, however this set is designed, whatever the lights look like, whatever the costumes are. Is it different being in this world in a way that it's not the same on stage?
Well, I think what you said, you're in the world, whatever it is. There certainly are some differences just in the fact that, you know, looking at what's behind us, it does seem as though these projections have made the space infinitely bigger than what it was. So we have much more of a world than we might otherwise have. Now, on the other hand, we also, as actors, have to be very aware of the actual physical space we're in. Our walls are projection screens, and we can't touch them. We have to be very careful. We have, you know, some swords in the play, and so we have to be very aware of where those are.
That's expensive to replace if the sword goes through it or
that's
something.
That's not in our budget.
Yeah.
So there are things that we have to be more aware of than we might have been in a different space. But I think what it adds is greater than any of the challenges that we face.
One of the things that's crucial for an audience, of course, is sitting over there in that chair, which are the 3D glasses. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like coming into a 3D film where you're not going to get it unless you put the glasses on too. So the audience is kind of coming into this, you know, this really cool thing where they become part of the technology as mm-hmm. well.
Well, yeah, the 3D glasses are absolutely necessary for the audience to be wearing, because without it, some of these things that actually, when you're wearing the glasses, seem like they're floating in midair in the middle of the space, things like the dagger and Hecate and the cauldron and things like that. If you're not wearing the glasses, then, yeah, you are definitely losing a lot of the importance of this experience. I mean, because this, to me, I keep telling people that we are doing theater of the future. I mean, I feel like I didn't think I would live long enough to see a day where the sets don't have to be built out of lumber and paint. The sets are just created out of a computer program and created in a way that it looks bigger than any theater set could ever look. I mean, this field that we have up right now, when you have the glasses on, it looks like the horizon is about 3 miles away. You can't really ever create that in just a regular theater with flats and paint. So that is one of the great things about this.
It sort of reminds me, for those of us who are Star Trek fans, it reminds me of the idea of being on the holodeck.
Yeah, I get that a lot.
Yeah, I bet you do. I bet you do.
Yeah, in fact, usually like when I have to describe what I do to my job, I try to describe what the cave is like. Usually people's response is like, oh, it's like the holodeck. But yeah, there's nothing that you can touch. I mean, the cave generally works for things that are bigger than the room, so it's a natural fit for engineering. It works really well for theater too, because when we design the cave, most caves are usually smaller and cubic. But we actually got some suggestions from the theater department that if we made it twice as wide and had a big seating area behind it, that makes it a whole lot more stage-like. So theater, the whole theater in an engineering lab concept was there right from the very beginning. And this is actually our eighth production.
Very cool.
We try to do one every semester, but this semester we've been doing a whole lot more.
What do you think Shakespeare would have made of this?
Oh, well, hard to say.
Do you think, as a theater person, do you think he'd like it?
Well, I would like to think that when he put on the 3D glasses and looked at the set, that he would have a moment where he might say, wow, and maybe even backwards. I think Shakespeare, if there was technology like this available, I think Shakespeare would embrace the opportunity to try to find a way to use it and incorporate it.
And he would have made up some new words to describe it, because
yeah.
he was very good at that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. So is this something Umbrella Group wants to do again with a different play in another semester, or is Chris tired of creating floating heads and daggers?
Umbrella Group is always keeping its mind open as far as the next project goes. So we never know for sure what we're doing next. If we did do something in here with Chris, I know personally of a play that I saw in London summer before last, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night, which I think would be a perfect fit for this space. So
stay tuned. Exactly.
Possibly.
And Todd, for you, more adaptations, more things coming down the way for you?
With this space in mind? Perhaps, yeah. Another play that we considered was looking at Twelfth Night, but when we get to Act 5 and everybody's on stage, it's like, okay, it was all going well until I got to Act 5, and
exactly.
Then it's like, nope, yeah. So, always looking for some plays either to adapt to fit or plays that are existing, which might on their own find a very happy home within this land of digital scenery.
All right. Well, I can't thank all of you enough for taking some time out to show me this. Best of luck getting Burnham Wood marching towards Dunsinane, and I know you will. I'm sure it will happen, but break a leg.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bo Johnson directs, Todd Denning and Libby Amato star, and Chris Larkey designed and runs the virtual reality elements of Umbrella Group Theater's Macbeth, which opens tonight and runs through April 21st at Marquette University's Marvel Lab Space in the School of Engineering on West Wisconsin Avenue. There is a link to more information and photos at WUWM.com.
Well, hopefully their production of Macbeth won't result in an actual murder, unlike a fictional production in writer Mindy Mejia's recent mystery. Well, we'll speak with her about that in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about Umbrella Group Theater's unique spin on Shakespeare's Macbeth that they'll perform in a virtual reality lab at Marquette University. But it was a high school production of Macbeth that went wrong and led to a murder in a small town in the rural Midwest.
Fortunately, that production was not real, not even virtually real, but it was the figment of Minnesota writer Mindy Mejia's imagination. It drives the plot of her recent mystery, Everything You Want Me to Be, and Mindy Mejia joined us in the studio back in February. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me today.
So let's get a couple of things out of the way first. This is a murder mystery, and so we will stop short of giving away too many plot points.
Yes.
But there are a few basics that we learned pretty early on. What are we comfortable talking about here?
Yeah, well, the basic premise is that on the opening night of her high school play, Hattie Hoffman is found stabbed to death near her home in an abandoned barn in rural southern Minnesota. Sheriff Del Goodman is assigned to investigate her murder, and he vows to find her killer. But what he discovers instead is that Hattie's acting talents ran far beyond the stage, and the facade of her perfect life hid secrets that could tear apart her small town community.
Right. And small towns, you know, I wonder if it was really necessary to set this in a small town, because small towns are such that we tend to think we know everyone.
Right, exactly. And that's the idea, that it is a close-knit community. And, you know, despite the kind of independence and resilience that a lot of those people have, they do know each other, and they pride themselves on having that close-knit community and that sense of belonging.
Well, and so Hattie is really the character that everything revolves around. How did you get to know Hattie? I mean, teenagers are tough enough to figure out, but she is really challenging.
Right. And the myth that I started this book with was that I could easily write a teenage character because I had been a teenage girl, right? But that was actually a while ago. and you forget. So luckily, I had saved all of my old high school journals. And so I went back and reread those just to kind of get back into the mindset of a teenager. And that was hugely helpful.
Can we say a little bit about who some of the other characters are? Because there's a pretty key plot point that happens pretty early in the book, and I won't mention it if you don't want me to, but she's definitely drawn to one of her teachers.
Exactly, yes. There's three point of view characters in the book, so Hattie, of course, is one of them. We hear her story in the 6 months leading up to her death. Del Goodman, the sheriff, is the other point of view character that's investigating her murder, and then the third point of view character is Peter Lund, who's the new English teacher in town. He's directing the play that Hattie stars in on the night of her death, and she is drawn to him. Hattie is someone who's always felt displaced in her community. She always had her sights set on what she thought of was bigger. You know, she wanted to go to New York. And Peter, having come from the Twin Cities, not a huge town, but
a lot bigger than Pine Valley.
A lot bigger than Pine Valley. So she's naturally drawn to him.
Well, right. And so, I mean, you set the book in rural southern Minnesota, where Rochester is the big city, and I put that in quotation marks.
Yeah.
It could easily be set in rural Wisconsin, and Appleton could be the big city, or mm-hmm. Green Bay, or whatever. But I guess the question is here, I wonder if one of the underrated elements to this book is the urban-rural divide.
That is something that I wanted to explore. The book was inspired, I mean, Pine Valley is a fictional town, but it was inspired by the towns where my grandparents farmed their entire lives, which was in southern Minnesota, south of Rochester. And I wanted to write a book about that type of community. But also, as I was growing up, I grew up in the Twin Cities in a small town that's kind of become a suburb over the years because of urban sprawl. But it was very much a small town when I lived there. And when I was growing up, I always had that, you know, sense that I needed to go somewhere bigger as well. You know, that I, you know, something about the urban area was going to be better for me. And that wasn't the case at all, you know, as I grew up. And now I live in the town next door to the town where I was raised. But I think there is that idea when you're growing up, you know, to try to go and be part of something, you know, bigger, maybe have more culture. And, you know, there's that myth of going in that direction. That was phrased really badly.
That's all right. I mean, it's not too dissimilar from the grass is always greener.
Exactly.
Cliche.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And I mean, there is a cultural divide, you know, between rural communities and urban communities that, you know, we don't always like to pay attention to, but it became pretty apparent in this last election.
Tell us a little bit more about Del. Del is the sheriff that is, I was going to say assigned, but he really kind of takes this case on because, you know, it's a small town. But he's a more interesting character than we might initially imagine.
Yeah, he's a Vietnam veteran, and so he's no stranger to bodies, murder. You know, he's seen it before, but he has been drawn to Pine Valley and considers that his home now because of its apparent safety and the fact that you don't have a lot of the murder rates, you know, more of the violence that you see in the larger urban areas. And so apart from knowing the victim and feeling that she was sort of his daughter, you know, the closest thing that he had to a daughter, he's also disturbed by the fact that this is happening in his town and is trying to get to the bottom of that. Personally, he was one of my favorite characters to write because he had the voice, not the personality or the motives, but the voice and the diction of my maternal grandfather.
What did you glean from your own high school journals, you know, and how in touch were you still with the things that you had been thinking in those days and writing about?
It was like reading someone else's journals. I mean, you're so far removed from that sensibility as you move on with your life and mature that it was kind of interesting to go back to that. What I gleaned the most was that there is this inherent narcissism in those years, you know, as you're really trying to figure out your identity and who you are, the boundaries of your world are expanding so rapidly and you're trying to figure out your place in it. And that was probably the closest I was going to be able to come to identify with Hattie because she's a very different person. She is a natural actress, a people pleaser in appearance, but she doesn't take on those roles altruistically. You know, she does it because she can.
Right. And one of the things that really kind of jumped out, I mean, I was thinking about my own teen years, which are, you know, fairly far in the past. But, you know, I remember going through high school and thinking, you know, this could be a movie. This could be a sitcom. This could be a TV show. and never being entirely sure about whether I was the star or a supporting character in it. But Hattie is absolutely sure she is front and center.
Yes. That's something that she knows. You know, she's more sure of that than almost anything else.
Well, and you, it looked like that was coming out in you as well. I mean, I wonder if that's a universal. We all sort of see ourselves in an acting role at that age.
I think there is a bit of that. I was never the actress that Hattie was. I was always happier with my nose in a book. So that's really where I spent my high school years and just trying to get out of high school. But
there's a lot of literature that comes out in this book.
There is, yeah. Some of my favorite books appear here. We get to canvas Jane Eyre, V by Thomas Pynchon, and of course Macbeth, which is the play that she's starring in that night.
Are we allowed to say that out loud?
We're not in the playhouse right now, so it's okay. But yes, there is a curse of Macbeth, which is triggered by saying the name of the play in the playhouse where it's being performed.
And Macbeth, there is a lot in Macbeth that is a good metaphor for what kind of plays out in this book.
Right. I mean, Macbeth was one of the most intense psychological studies that Shakespeare made. It was one of his four great tragedies. And it's interesting because Macbeth was not a man, you know, like Othello. You know, he wasn't evil. He wasn't suicidal like Hamlet. He wasn't blinded or stupid. You know, he was an ordinary man, you know, like you or I, who was tempted, understood the cost, and succumbed anyway.
The book jumps around in time, you know, pre-murder and post-murder, what, 6 months leading up to the murder and in the days following the murder. How did you piece it together for yourself? Where did the story actually start for you?
The story started for me pretty much where we start in the book, which, apart from a quick prologue, we are in the barn with Del seeing this body. And so that's how it first came to me, was the image of this abandoned, decrepit barn with a body inside.
Well, and did you know who did it from the get-go?
I did not. It was about four chapters from the end of the first draft where I figured it out. And I think in retrospect, that might have helped, you know, because I wasn't writing in that direction. And so hopefully, since it surprised me, it might surprise a reader.
Do you have to go back and kind of retrofit everything that you have written to that point to make sure it lines? I mean, obviously you do.
Yes. Yeah. There's definitely some revision involved in that then when you understand who your murderer is and just setting that up so that when you get to the end, you have that surprising yet inevitable feeling where you can kind of pull on those threads that you've been building.
Right. I mean, there has to be an art to making it a surprise while at the same time making it believable.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we've all read those books that just have the crazy twist at the end. And you're like, well, where did that come from? You know, and it's not quite as satisfying as seeing things come together and stack up in the direction that they were building.
Hattie is, and I think we can use this without giving anything away, a fairly manipulative person.
She is.
At the same time, do you feel for her as the author creating her and setting her into motion?
I did. I did have a lot of sympathy for Hattie. I think she is a manipulator, but at the same time, she manipulates herself and convinces herself of things as she's doing them. And so she's as much a victim of her manipulations as she is the perpetrator.
And when you're a high schooler, things can easily spiral out of control especially in your own mind.
Exactly. You can set things in motion without really understanding the full consequences of your actions. And obviously that's what's happening here.
What did you feel for Peter?
I was sympathetic to Peter as well. I was probably less sympathetic to him than the other two characters, but I did have sympathy for Peter. He got into a situation where he married young and he wasn't really prepared to move out into this rural area where his wife was from in order to care for her dying mother. That's not really what he signed up for, and he didn't have the maturity to evolve with that as the situation demanded.
And he always saw himself as this kind of big city person who had ended up in a small town.
He did. He was very much this burgeoning hipster, you know, in 2007 and identified with the urban areas where he was from.
2007 is not that long ago in the grand scheme of things, but it is 10 years ago. Was there a certain amount of work you had to do to make sure that that the stuff that was happening in 2007 was really happening in 2007?
I did some fact checking, yes. And there are certain parts of the book that it felt critical to move us back to that because that was really before. I mean, you think only 10 years ago, but smartphones weren't as highly used then, you know.
There was right, a little Facebook bit, doesn't really show up.
And there was no real social media, you know, that's kind of commonplace now that you just take for granted. So even going only back 10 years, there are some significant differences in how we related to each other.
You wrote this book even as you're pursuing your other career in the accounting world. when do you find time to write? And is this book brewing in the back of your mind while you're keeping track of numbers?
Yes, don't tell my boss.
Boss has to know at some level.
Yeah. I primarily write on my lunch breaks at work. That's my main writing time because when I get home, I have young children. And so that's the best time that I have to really check out and go into these worlds that I'm creating. So I write during lunch, but I'll try to think about the scene that I'm working on that day as I'm commuting into work. And, you know, it's always kind of boiling in the back of my head to make those connections. And so sometimes in meetings, I do I do end up straying into the book a little bit.
Well, it has to be a little bit surreal to be sitting there and crunching numbers or going from that to lunch and having to write these gory details and then go back to the button-down world of accounting.
Yeah, exactly. You know, sometimes people will come in during my lunch break and I'm writing and they're asking me this accounting question and I'm like, I'm trying to stab someone to death right now. Can you wait? You know, the car chase is almost done. Just hang on a second. We'll get to you.
So have your coworkers read this? Do they know about this side of you?
Yes. Now that the book has come out, some of them have read it, have been out to some of the events that we've had in the Twin Cities for the book tour. And it's been really interesting to see how these different areas of my life mash up.
Well, Mindy Mejia, it's a page-turner in the best sense of the word. Thank you so much.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me.
Minnesota writer Mindy Mejia's recent murder mystery is called Everything You Want Me to Be. Our interview with her first aired in February, shortly after she was in town for an event at Boswell Book Company.
We'll take one more break and then catch our weekly installment of Bubbler Talk, and we'll be joined by musician John Seeger for his monthly Beatdown performance. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Sometimes we come across questions that confound us. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Do we truly have free will? And this week's profound Bubbler Talk question. What's up with the ham and rolls, Milwaukee?
It's more a Milwaukee Southside tradition.
Carl Canfora and his wife Rosalba own Canfora Bakery in Bayview. It's 8:30 a.m. on a Sunday, and the line for hot ham and rolls snakes through the tiny store. Rosalba says Canfora does about 20% of its business between the hours of 7 and 1 on Sundays.
Now, I heard that you guys are one of the best. What makes you so good?
That's a secret.
But why the high demand for ham and rolls on Sunday morning?
It's like a fish fry on a Friday evening.
That insight from Brian Schwellinger. He's operations manager at Badger Boiled Ham. Some call it the Cadillac of ham. The smell rushes at you as you walk into the kitchen.
I'm starting to smell it.
Yes. We cook the hams in hot water and we use steam.
Just like with fish fries, Schwellinger points to Catholicism as the reason the ham roll combo is a big deal here. He says the city's many Catholics were not supposed to eat before Mass on Sundays, so by the time church let out, people wanted something fast and filling. He says it started just after World War II.
Small grocery stores and bakeries were trying to distinguish themselves, and this was really the first of convenience food, easy meal. Dessert was there, and there was competition. And Dutchland Dairy started that in the 40s.
But according to Schwellinger, the marketing push was the brainchild of a guy named Bob Moyer. Now, if you've been around Milwaukee for a while, you may have heard of Moyer Brothers Bakery. After consulting Google, I found that the company is now located in Fond du Lac. I ended up on the phone with Andrea Moyer, but she told me...
The guy you really need to talk to is Bob.
Is so, Bob still alive?
He is. I don't have his phone number, but I can get it for you.
That would be freaking amazing. Within minutes, I had Bob on the line. He didn't take all the credit for the brilliant marketing of a simple ham sandwich.
A good friend of mine in the bakery business, it was called Bomberg's Bakery. I asked him, how is that 6 free rolls going? And he says, fine. We just started that. But we're going to be going out of business. So I said, well, maybe I could pick up on that. He says, go ahead. You're free to do that.
Moyer says the secret may have always been giving away a half dozen rolls with each pound of ham.
People like the word free.
At nearly 80 years old, Moyer says he still eats hot ham and hard rolls every Sunday, but he doesn't buy it from a bakery.
I buy mine, which is a Badger Boil ham product, at a Century store in Delafield.
Yep. Grocery stores now play a huge part in continuing the hot ham and hard roll tradition.
Bubbler Talk is a production of WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, and made possible by the Board Game Barrister, satisfying Milwaukee's thirst for fun with games, classic toys, and puzzles for all ages. Locations at Bayshore, Greenfield, South Milwaukee, and now Mayfair. Do you have a question about Milwaukee you want answered? Well, submit it to us at WUWM.com and maybe we'll quench your thirst for knowledge.
Milwaukee singer-songwriter John Seeger joins us each month for a segment that we call the Monthly Beatdown. He joins us this morning with a couple of fellow semi-twang bandmates, Mike Seeger and Mike Hoffman.
Well, gentlemen, hello. It's great to see you again.
Hi, Bonnie.
So, John, you got the usual crowd here.
I know. I got
the two mics.
Yeah, the usual suspects.
So I understand you guys got a gig tonight.
We do. We do. We're playing at Anodyne. And we haven't played in about 6 months, I don't think.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. We've been working on a record.
And how's that going?
That's going really well. It's got a cool vibe to it. We're working at Chris Hansen's studio, and he's got a microphone that costs more than it's actually worth more than me. If you had to choose, you'd save the. If that studio was on, you know, there's a fire, they'd just leave me up there and run out with a mic.
Yep.
I would, myself.
Does it make
you
sound fantastic, though? Is that the
thing? Yeah, it's a Neumann, and it's big and lush. And he's got many other, like, RCAs. And
yeah, he's got a collection of things up there.
So when's the album supposed to be out?
I'm shooting for summer, but, you know, it'd be, you never can tell.
Are you still recording, or are you in the post-production?
We're finishing some songs, and I'm thinking about getting back in for one or two more. So it needs a little injection of pep, and I've got the songs. So, and my wife always says toe tappers, you know, because she's tired of the balladeer.
She doesn't want to be depressed. She wants to like dance. What kind of tunes tonight? Are you stuff from the new album, or are you going to go back to the back catalog?
Do about five from the new album. Okay. We're going to do one little quick tribute to Chuck Berry, who we all adored and grew up playing. And then some of the old standards from the golden era and the last two records we made. And
okay.
So it's going to be a mishmash. We're going to have Chris DeMay with us, who was in Juniper Tar. I don't know their status, if they're on hiatus or hiatus, as a friend of mine called it. But he's working on a record, too, and it's going to be a good one.
So is he opening for you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool.
He's going to open solo.
Well, guys, I want to thank you for coming in. Best of luck at the gig.
Thank you.
And finishing up the record. When you get the record done, let's bring the whole band in.
We'll do that.
That would be great.
Blow the roof off this place.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's hear the tune. What is the tune?
This is called When the Wind Kicks Up, and I've been singing this 20 years, maybe.
Yeah.
All right?
Yep.
I got dreams that don't fit in this town. They're a little too big. When the wind kicks up, I'll see you around. Half of my heart I will leave right here. I'll be traveling light. When the wind kicks up, I'll see you around. When the wind kicks up, it's gonna change my love. I'm pulling up stakes from the place I was stuck. Now the sun, it's a big red ball, and it's going down. I don't wanna get caught. When the wind kicks up, I'll see you around.
And when the wind kicks up, it's gonna rearrange pieces of a life written on a change. Now the sun.
John Seeger, Mike Seeger, and Mike Hoffman with a tune, When the Wind Kicks Up, for our regular segment, The Monthly Beatdown with John Seeger. Semi Twang plays a show at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point tonight. You can find a link at WUWM.com. And that is all for the Friday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski. We get production assistance from Mayon Silver and Sarah Matthews, and additional reporting from Susan Bentz and Rachel Morello.
We also get web and social media support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from John Strelecki. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7. WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. We're just about an hour away from all the latest news from around the country and the world on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now, it's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.